Welcome to the McCarthy Reports podcast, where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? Biden's presser and the Texas synagogue hostage taking. You, of course, listening to a National View podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, 5-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
How are you, Rich?
I'm good. Andy, you?
I'm good. I'm getting ready for, we were talking a little bit about it, a big weekend of football. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, should be some interesting ones. Got my Titans on Saturday afternoon against the Bengals, who have been hot and have a great quarterback. And then I guess on Sunday we have a big Bills Chiefs matchup.
Yeah. The games are good. As I told you, my pick for the Super Bowl is the Rams and the Bills. So by the time we get back next week, I'll probably have no teams left, but that's my pick and I'm sticking with it.
All right. So let's hit this Biden press conference, at least briefly. Just astonishing. I'm not sure there's ever been a worse presidential press conference. Obviously Trump had some doozies, but I'm not sure anything Trump ever said was as potentially as consequential and harmful as what Biden said about Russia.
Yeah, I just thought, Rich, it was one of those things where when you're listening to it, you know you heard what he said, but you I couldn't believe it. So I figured I must have had it wrong.
I had exactly the same feeling.
Yeah, and I had to, you know, fortunately, you know, we were a lot of us were commenting and listening at the same time. So I quickly saw that I wasn't the only one who heard it that way. And it wasn't long before he doubled down on it. So it really wasn't. By the end of the press conference, he had made the same point two or three times. And I kept thinking, you know, here are these journalists who are clearly, you know, they're pro-democratic, but they weren't asking sugar-coated questions, but they kept going back to it because they were trying to help him dig out of the hole. Mm-hmm. And he just kept making it worse. So
yeah, well, I think the first follow-up was a little bit went to the reaction that you're just alluding to that we all had. Did you just say that? Did you just green light a minor incursion? But I had the same reaction you did. I had to see it on Twitter before I believed it, which reminds me a little bit. Our colleague Jay Nordlinger occasionally jokes about how now he doesn't stick his hand out the window to see what the weather is. He looks at his phone. And I had this experience the other day. It's cold here in the Northeast, and I was in a parking lot of a grocery store, and I was debating whether I had my heavy winter coat in the seat next to me, whether to put it on. It's cumbersome. And I didn't have that far to walk, and I had the door of the car open, but I still had to look at my phone to see actually what the temperature was. I didn't trust my own judgment of what the air temperature was. But so where are you on Russia, Ukraine? There's splits on the right on this, where folks who are more a realist or paleo, and you've been associated in that tendency and a lot of things, democracy building in the Middle East, et cetera. Where are you on how harmful it would be if Putin goes in and what we should do about it?
Well, I think it would be very harmful. I would not be willing to commit American troops to Ukraine, but I do think we should, you know, we should arm them. I'm kind of torn on this, Rich, because I've never changed on Russia. You know, like I'm kind of an unreconstructed Cold Warrior that way. I think they're an enemy of the United States, and I've been very critical in our pages over the years of both Republican and Democratic administrations who regarded Russia expressly as a strategic partner, like a country that we could really rely on and that we had mutual interest with, and you know, as a result, we could find common ground and work together with them. Where I think that Russia is just always looking to make trouble for the United States. This Russia obviously is an epigon compared to the Soviet Union. And I think sometimes we talk about Putin like he's 10 feet tall, and I think of him more like a kind of a mafia thug. So, you know, I think sometimes we do overreact to Russia, and I think there are a lot of things that we can do short of having to introduce American troops in a combat theater to make their lives miserable if we were willing to do them. But I always think reality starts with recognizing what you're dealing with, and what we're dealing with here is an enemy of the United States, not a regime that can be appeased or convinced to see things our way. And that doesn't mean we have to be at war with them. I think when we deal with them, we need to recognize what we're dealing with. And the Democrats always talk a good game about Russia when Republicans are in power, particularly Trump. But we all knew that the minute Trump was gone, they would go back to, you know, the playbook, which is to appease them at every turn. Although the degree to which Biden has done so, and particularly with this minor incursion rhetoric the other day, is just astonishing. On the other side of the coin, you know, we talk about Ukraine, and I went into this a lot in my book, Ball of Collusion, about the Russiagate insanity. But we talk about Ukraine as if it was this like sort of single stratum, unified country that longs to be part of the West. And I think that Ukraine is much more complicated than that, not least because, you know, unlike countries in the West that can say and think whatever they want to think about Russia, Ukraine's got a very long border with a hostile country that it can't, as a practical matter, defend itself from. And by the way, it can't, as a practical matter, defend itself from Russia for large, with the United States having done an awful lot to bring about that condition, including in 1998, getting them to give up their nukes on the promise that their security would be taken care of by Russia and the United States and Britain, which was preposterous. And then when Obama was the senator, he led a big initiative in Congress to get the Ukrainians to give up a lot of their conventional weapons as well. So, you know, to the extent that the Ukrainians are behind the eight ball here, our hands are not very clean in that regard. And as a result of that, I do think that we have some stepped up obligation, because we actually did convince them to disarm themselves. But at the same time, you know, Ukraine's a lousy country. When Trump said that Ukraine was a lousy country, he was not wrong about that. You know, they have it's a very complicated country. They have, you know, elements that want to be, probably a preponderance of the country that wants to be with the West. But they have a lot of pro-Russia elements in the East, and a big part of the power structure of the country are these oligarchs, like their fellow oligarchs in Russia, who got rich in the kind of Wild West era of capitalism right after the Soviet Union fell. This is like mafia capitalism, where, you know, it was survival of the fittest, and that's how all these guys ended up, you know, becoming multi-billionaires, basically by capturing the country's resources. And there's a lot of disturbing elements in Ukraine. So I just think it's a very complicated country, and I think we should help them because we've had a lot to do with disarming them. And because strategically, anything that's bad for Russia is good for us. I don't want to oversimplify it, but I think that continues to be true. So I think we ought to make this as punishing for Russia as we can without having to commit American troops. But I do pretty much anything else besides commit American troops. But I also think, Rich, that sanctions will work a lot better if you just resolve that Russia's an enemy. You know, we're very hesitant about what we do with them, because it's like with Iran, like the bipartisan progressive foreign policy community in Washington always thinks we're like, you know, just around the corner from the big deal with Iran, where there's going to be this rapprochement and everything's going to be wonderful. And of course, it never happens. And all we really do is signal to them that we're so desperate to get a deal that we can be had, and we frequently are had. And I think we do the same thing with Russia. I think things would work a lot better if you just recognize who they are.
Yeah. So let's hit another big story, which is the Texas hostage taking from last weekend. So small matter of business here. Pronunciation of the perpetrator, Akram, is his last name?
Yeah, Akram, I believe, is how he pronounced it. Yeah.
So he comes here. He's a Brit, but he comes here on a tourist visa, stays briefly in a hotel in Queens, and then heads to Texas and engages in this horrific hostage taking. Fortunately, no one was hurt besides himself, and he was shot and killed. But what's basically a land here? And then the big question is, how did this guy with his background get into the United States?
Yeah, Rich, this was really an infuriating story, in the sense that the column I wrote about this right after it happened was, you know, basically the FBI saved the day and then muffed everything with the messaging. And it's probably they did muff everything with the messaging, but it's not even clear they saved the day. But the biggest, you know, the thing that got the most attention was the FBI's tin-eared messaging and whether they were straight with people about what actually happened in the mosque that resulted in Malik Faisal Akram being killed. Like, did he shoot himself? Did the hostage rescue guys, the FBI's elite trained hostage rescue unit, did they take him out? What actually happened in there? So we don't really know the answers to that yet. And that is what pretty much consumed people. But I really think, as you suggest, the big issue here is, how on earth did this guy get into the United States under circumstances where, under federal law — now, we're not talking about policy now, we're not talking about like the Biden administration's proclivities about aliens and immigration and enforcement and all that stuff. I'm just talking about like federal law. You are excludable as an alien if you have a criminal record that has what they call crimes of moral turpitude, which is a very vast array that this guy easily checks the box on. He had a criminal record in Britain. If you have a history of mental illness — this guy evidently had that as well — and if you have been a member of or in any way endorsed terrorism, or, you know, a member of a terrorist organization. And this guy not only endorsed the 9/11 attacks, in a very unusual move, he was actually banned from a courthouse in his hometown in Britain. And the court went to paper on it and basically said he had menaced people after 9/11 in rhetoric that was very pro the terrorists of 9/11, and had said expressly that he wished he had been there with them and had taken one of the planes and flown it into the targets where, you know, nearly 3,000 Americans were killed. So my point in laying that out is that any one of those three things — criminal record, mental illness, terrorism — would be enough to ding someone, to make them excludable, disqualified from entering the United States. He has all three. And we know that Britain is a visa waiver country, which means that many of its citizens don't have to comply with the normal visa requirements to come to the United States. We have reciprocal arrangements with them about that. You're not qualified for the visa waiver program if you've even had arrests. you know, forget about convictions. So Akram would not have been qualified to go into the visa waiver bucket. He would have had to, in order to come to the United States, he would have had to apply for a visa the regular way, which means there should be a heightened level of scrutiny to the application. And it should have been clear that he wasn't qualified to come here. Then you have the situation of counterterrorism cooperation between governments. The United States and Britain are supposed to be the gold standard in the first world for counterterrorism cooperation. I mention that because Akram was into the year 2020 on Britain's watch list of what they call persons of interest. And for them, that's like their highest level of watch list. Now, I want to be fair to the Brits because this is a very hard job. In recent years, the number of people that they have monitored for fears about terrorist activity has doubled. From 2017 to now, they've gone from about 21,000 to 43,000. They have 43,000 people that they're monitoring to some degree or another. And they maintain two lists. One is persons of interest. Those are the ones that they're most concerned about. And there's about 3,000 of them right now. And then they have another list of mainly people who were persons of interest, but they've cleared them. So they're on like, they're like former persons of interest. There's 40,000 of those. Now, if we just stick with the 3,000, the expert estimates from within British law enforcement and academia that studies this stuff is it takes about 12 agents, you know, intelligence agents, law enforcement agents, to effectively monitor a single terrorist if they're going to watch them all the time. So just doing the math, if you take, you know, the fact that they have 3,000 people that they're subjecting to this kind of scrutiny, they don't have, they wouldn't have resources to do any other law enforcement intelligence if that's all they did. So there's a lot of pressure to clear people who were on the list who shouldn't be on the list, not because they're trying to preserve resources, but because they need to make sure that they're not wasting their time on somebody who they mm-hmm. shouldn't be following and missing somebody who they should be. So I think they probably clear people they shouldn't clear, and they do it faster than they should. And evidently with Akram, sometime in 2020, they moved him from, you know, the top list, the persons of interest list, to the other list. It seems to me, even though they moved him from one list to the other, that doesn't mean if he had to apply for a visa that our intelligence service should not have known from the British intelligence service that he was somebody they were monitoring for fear of jihadist activity. So even besides the fact that he should have been automatically excludable because of the categories I mentioned at the beginning, he should have been fleshed out just by intelligence sharing between the two countries, which is why I come to what I think is the biggest concern here that has gotten the least attention, which is, and I know a little bit about this, Rich, because this is the one aspect of Trump's campaign, biggest concern here that has gotten the least attention, which is, and I know a little bit about this, Rich, because this is the one aspect of Trump's campaign in 2020, in 2016, where I got asked to give them a little bit of advice. And that was Trump wanted to ratchet up vetting for aliens who were coming to the United States from places around the world that were obvious hotbeds of jihadist ideology. Now, he didn't put it that way. You know, he put it in his clumsy way. I think ultimately, it was called a Muslim ban. And he said enough things along those lines that it could be confused for a Muslim ban. But the people who were trying to give him advice on how to do this, like me, were trying to figure out a way that you could categorize jihadist ideology as a counter-constitutional political ideology that should be disqualifying, as opposed to a religion that has First Amendment protection. In other words, we weren't talking about all Muslims. We're talking about people who had a demonstrated connection either to organizations or to places that were hotbeds of jihadist ideology. And they're not that hard to map. We map them all the time for various intelligence reasons. All of this advice that Trump got in 2016 resulted ultimately in some executive orders that he issued at the beginning of his administration. And by the time they were issued and refined, they were completely legal. And what they urged our agencies to do within the bounds of American statutory and constitutional law was to heighten vetting for people who were coming to the United States from various areas of the world that were notorious for jihadist ideology, and also to the extent that people had certain attributes, like we discussed with Akram, you know, these categorical reasons that you would keep people out of the country, to subject those people to heightened scrutiny before letting them come in the country. I lay that all that out because when Biden came into office, one of the first things he did was countermand Trump's guidance on heightened vetting for aliens coming into the United States. And what I'm fearful of is the ethos of an administration comes obviously from the top. And if the president instructs everyone that vetting of aliens who want to come into the United States is no longer a priority for the United States government, and then you see in this particular instance, somebody who for about like seven ways to Sunday should have been excluded from the United States gets into the country and then, you know, commits a terrorist activity. You know, obviously two and two are four. We're asleep at the switch with respect to stopping people who shouldn't be in the United States from coming in. And I think we have a government-wide problem here. This is not just about this one particular incident at the synagogue. I think people are rightfully worried that we have let our guard down about who we're letting in this country. And the only reason for them to have done that is because it was Trump's policy to heighten vetting. And that seems to me to be like a stupid reason to not do vetting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you alluded earlier to your column saying that FBI did a good job operationally, but then screwed up the communication afterwards. And there's been a lot of mockery now about the statements we heard from Biden and others. We don't know this guy's motive. You know, it's still a mystery to us. He wasn't deliberately targeting Jews, although he had to go really out of his way to find a synagogue. So what do you make of that aspect of this?
Well, I was willing to cut the Bureau some slack. And this is, Rich, this is like grading on a very low curve, right? So, you know, we've heard the FBI, and especially during the Obama administration, when they were talking the nonsense about, you know, man-caused disasters and you know, that whole glossary that we poked fun at for 8 years while we had terrorist attack after terrorist attack. To his credit, I think Biden came out rapidly and said this was a terrorist attack, which it was. So, you know, this is removed from the worst of the Obama stuff. And as far as what this agent had to say, and I should point out here, the agent who made the statements that people rightfully got whipped up about is a guy named Matthew DeSarno. And I think if you read some of the coverage, you would say, well, you know, look, it's just a spokesman for the FBI who got the messaging screwed up. This guy is not merely a spokesman for the FBI. He is the special agent in charge of the Dallas field office, which is one of the, you know, the area wise, it's one of the biggest offices in the FBI in the country. And it's one of the most important jobs of the FBI in the country. So he's not just, you know, like a press person who got it wrong. This is like a guy who is in the upper ranks of the FBI who knows exactly what the messaging is and what the, you know, where the bureau is coming from on this stuff. So he comes out and he says, we do believe from our engagement with Akram, they weren't mentioning his name yet at this point. This is Saturday night when this all broke. We believe from our engagement with him that he was, and this is a quote, singularly focused on one issue, and it was not specifically related to the Jewish community. Now, obviously, what he did was related to the Jewish community. He traveled 1,600 miles mm-hmm. from Queens to Fort Worth to get to a synagogue. He wanted to be in Fort Worth, and this is what I think DeSarno obviously meant by he was singularly, that Akram was singularly focused on one issue. Akram was trying to extort the United States government to release another jihadist whose name is Afia Siddiqui. In some of the tabloids, she's been referred to as Madam or Lady Al-Qaeda. She's somebody who materially supported the Taliban, an American, I think a native Pakistani American educated academic who's often described in the media as a neuroscientist. I think it'd be more obvious. She's probably, you know, a biologist and an archaeologist. But in any event, she's a radical Islamist. And she provided material support to the Taliban. She ended up divorcing her husband and marrying the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the Al-Qaeda mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, on the basis of intelligence that was available to the FBI, which, by the way, we all know that the government, interviewed KSM at great length. She was linked to a jihadist cell that was purportedly plotting attacks in the United States, Britain, and Pakistan. She ends up getting captured in Afghanistan during the war with the Taliban, among other enemies there. And when they went to interview her, somebody in the military got a little careless with the firearm, which she managed to grab and shot, I think, two of our troops with. She didn't kill anyone, but she clearly attempted to murder them. So that's her background. She's also rabidly anti-Semitic. During her terrorism trial, she asked the judge if they could do genetic testing on the jurors because she wanted to determine whether they have had Jewish blood. So she's a real winner. And this is the woman, her release has been kind of a cause célèbre in Islamist circles. There's been a number of CARE events. There's been a number of these big Islamic organizations. And one of the big causes is, free Dr. Siddiqui, because they misrepresent what her background was and what crime she was convicted of. But she's doing an 86-year terrorism sentence, and they have her in a prison, the federal government does, about 24 miles from where this mosque was in this little town called Colleyville, which is on the outskirts of Fort Worth. So that's the reason the guy was in Fort Worth. But he was at a mosque because anti-Semitism is a key component of jihadist ideology. And we shouldn't, what the FBI is frightened to death of is the wrath of these Islamic organizations, especially when there's a democratic administration in power, because the Islamic organizations have a lot of influence with democratic administrations. They have influence with Republican administrations too, but they have a lot with democratic administrations. And the FBI, as it has always been, is afraid of saying anything that would be perceived or could be twisted into their saying that all Muslims are anti-Semites. So they're, they trip over their language all the time and they say stupid stuff. So what this guy said was that Akram was singularly focused on one issue and not specifically related to the Jewish community. Obviously, his plot was related to the Jewish community because he took hostages in a synagogue, which he went to on Saturday when he knew there would be services there, which was an opportune time to take Jewish hostages. So to say that it wasn't specifically related to the Jewish community was stupid. But what I think he was trying to convey is that Akram's main objective was to get the release of Siddiqui, to trade hostages to get the American government to release Siddiqui, and that the FBI did not believe that this incident meant that there was a more general and broad-based conspiracy to attack Jewish synagogues throughout the United States and take hostages. The problem is, why didn't he just say that? Instead, you know, he says this thing that he said, which was idiotic, and they were rightly ridiculed for it. But I don't think he was trying to say this had nothing to do with the Jewish community. What I think he was trying to convey was that there was no general plot on the Jewish community.
So speaking of idiocy, we have this Manhattan DA who's gotten a lot of attention last couple of weeks. Alvin Bragg, classic instance of one of these progressive prosecutors who has zero interest in prosecuting, released a first day memo that was just astonishing, that said armed robberies could be treated as misdemeanors. Huge furor driven by the New York Post, others. And he's been backtracking last several days. He's tried to say, well, look, this is a miscommunication and I could have put it better in the memo, and the memo is full of legalese, so I should have known it would be misunderstood by a lot of people. And then yesterday, we're recording early Friday afternoon here, held a press conference or some sort of press availability where he kind of backed off at least some of the memo. So who is this guy? What did the first memo say, and how much of it has he walked back?
Well, he's a former federal prosecutor who also worked for Senator Schumer on the Judiciary Committee. He's friendly with Preet Bharara. I think he worked with Bharara, I think, on Schumer's staff. He may also have been an assistant in the Southern District when Bharara was the U.S. attorney. I'm not certain about that. But, you know, he's a self-described progressive prosecutor. And Rich, I have to say, you know, I mean, part of well, I am, and you grew to be, we're New Yorkers, people who've lived in New York. We hate to see what's happened to the city, especially given the 30 years that it took to take the city from the badlands that it was by 1990. And that was like a 25-year period of dysfunction and high crime to being the safest big city in the world. So to watch that, you know, day after day, to watch all that progress get washed down the drain because people don't want to enforce the laws is terrible. But at the same time, Alvin Bragg did not misrepresent who he was when he was running for district attorney. And just to be clear to people, yes, New York is a one-party state, but they had a very competitive primary this time around. And there were a number of people who were running against him who were certainly left of center people. It's almost like it's baked in the cake in New York anymore that that's how it has to be. But you know, there were much more reasonable people who could have been elected. And this guy ran as a progressive prosecutor who said that, you know, basically law enforcement under disparate impact theory is racist, and we have, you know, systemic racism, and the only way to deal with it is not to prosecute people and not to incarcerate them. So in a lot of ways, you know, you scratch your head, but you say, you know, New York is getting what they voted for with this guy. And he didn't. It's not like one of these situations where he pretended he was one thing and then he got into office and turned into something else. The memo, the day one memo that is now so notorious, is pretty much what he ran on. It's very different when a guy is campaigning and he clothes himself as a social justice warrior who's upset about George Floyd, and then he gets into office and now he's responsible for the lives of people. And now suddenly people are like, well, when when you said you weren't going to prosecute, we didn't mean think you meant like you weren't going to prosecute.
Yeah, that memo is a classic version of the so-called Kinsley gaffe, which was saying something that's true, but and this was a version because it was saying something he believed clearly.
Yes, exactly. Totally correct. And what underscores how totally correct that is, Rich, is the fact that when people objected to it, he seemed shocked. You know, he's like, he's reeling a little bit because he's like, but you know, number one, this is what I ran on. But number two, how could anyone else think any other way? You know, so, you know, look, he's not a good person. Like all of these progressive prosecutors, my attitude about them is, you know, if they want to be defense lawyers, they should be defense lawyers. And there's a place for good defense lawyers who are very effective. But you don't want somebody who doesn't philosophically believe that enforcing the law is a good idea to be the chief prosecutor. There's a lot of, you know, legitimate jobs you could do. That's not, it's not one that you want to put someone like this in. And I think, you know, the thing with the memo, which, you know, he's now lying about the memo because he realizes that politically, now that he's in a different job other than, you know, besides being a campaigner, he's now like responsible and accountable. He's now trying to pretend that the memo says something that it doesn't, which Nicole Jalinas, for example, you mentioned the New York Post, caught him on dead to right, where, you know, he basically said that people just didn't understand what the memo said. And she was like, no, we understand what it says. And she laid out exactly what the law was that he was talking about. And he clearly was saying that he was not going to prosecute armed robbery as a felony. Here's the thing with these progressive prosecutors. And I'm going to write about this for the weekend column. But the thing I think people need to focus on with this is the concept of prosecutorial discretion, because by distorting that concept, what these guys are doing is exactly what conservatives for a half a century have been very effective at outing judges over, which is their job is not to make the law. You know, we've been very effective, Rich, and, you know, thank God for Justice Scalia on this one, but it's now accepted law in the United States. Why this needed to be an argument, who knows, but it's now an accepted principle that a judge's job is to apply the law as it's written, not to make up the law. And that is such an accepted concept at this point that even progressive judges, when they have confirmation hearings, at least have to pretend that they respect the text of a statute. And when judges don't respect the text of the statute, when they don't even act like it's important, judges almost never do that anymore because they get reversed so frequently. So we've done a very good job, I think, of communicating to people that it's the judge's job to apply the law as written, not to make up the law as the judge goes along. And I think that that's something that's been drilled into, drilled by conservatives into the public consciousness enough that it's now become a real standard in judicial evaluations, judicial confirmations, and the like. We've done a terrible job, unfortunately, understanding that it's the same principle when you're talking about prosecutors. That is, the prosecutor's job is to enforce the laws that the legislature has written, not to rewrite the laws and not to make up new laws as they go along. And progressives try to get around this two ways. One, they say, well, prosecutors are different and executive officials in general are different from judges because they're accountable. They get elected. You know, so if the people want, you know, if Alvin Bragg runs around and says, I'm not going to enforce the law, and then the people elect him and he doesn't enforce the law, then, you know, progressives say this is what people voted for. And if you look at Philadelphia, Larry Krasner is, you know, he's like the model of what Bragg wants to become. He not only got elected, he got reelected with like 3/4 of the vote. So, you know, they say, look, politically, these people are just doing what the public wants. And I think the answer to that is twofold. One is a lot of the public is voting with their feet in the sense that they're leaving these jurisdictions, you know, so that means that they're even more captured by these radical elements. But, you know, the people who care deeply about law and order, it's not like they're being outvoted, they're leaving. And the ones who remain are getting outvoted, but there are fewer and fewer of them. And secondly, and more importantly, in a constitutional republic, an election is not a license to ignore the law. The whole point of having a constitution is to defend the rights of mainly of civil rights of minorities. So when somebody gets elected, they don't get to say that, well, I got elected so I can do whatever the hell I want now. You still have, you know, they take an oath to follow the law, and their job is to faithfully execute the laws. That's what the gig is. So the fact that these guys have been elected does not relieve them of the obligation to enforce the laws, which gets to Bragg's main argument here and the main argument that's used by progressive prosecutors. And that is this idea of prosecutorial discretion. Now, this is another one of these things like, you know, Bragg saying, well, you just didn't understand my memo because it was all that legal stuff. And, you know, if you're not trained, you don't really understand. You don't have the Rosetta Stone to grasp my meaning here. Prosecutorial discretion is a concept like that. You know, they think they can just say prosecutorial discretion. That means I can basically make the law into what I want it to be. And as we've discussed a few times on the podcast over the years, prosecutorial discretion is simply a resource allocation doctrine, which stands for the unavoidable proposition that there is more crime than there are resources to combat crime. So you have to target your prosecutorial resources in the places where they're going to have the most bang for the buck. So you go for the, you know, the more serious crime. And if that ends up meaning you let some of the less serious stuff go, that's a sensible allocation of resources. It is not a license either to turn the law into something that it's not, or to suggest that the crimes that you're not prosecuting because you don't have the resources to prosecute them are not actual crimes, that it's now innocent behavior. And yet this is what these prosecutors try to do. So one of the things that I thought was most offensive in Bragg's memo, for example, is he instructs all of the ADAs, the assistant district attorneys who work for him, our priority here is going to be accountability, not years of sentence. It's a very telling thing to say, even though it sounds innocent enough. Accountability is a nice word, you know, just like equity and sustainability and, you know, all those words the left loves so much. But what he means by accountability is, well, let me just take it the other way. If a prosecutor is looking at years of sentence in exercising prosecutorial discretion, what that means is the prosecutor is applying the laws that the legislature has written, which basically say, you know, if you commit X crime, you get Y sentence. If you commit armed robbery, this is the sentence. If you commit murder, this is the sentence. What Bragg is saying is we're going to go with accountability. And what that means is the prosecutor should evaluate how serious the prosecutor thinks the conduct is and then come up with some way to treat it, whether it's some diversion from a sentencing of incarceration, you know, some way not to imprison, some way to plead the case so that the crime that's charged is no longer representative of the conduct that happened. And we walk away from that, even though we haven't applied, even though the legislature has said, when someone commits armed robbery, this is the sentence. What we come away from this saying is, we've looked at this and we've determined in fairness, this is how this person should have been treated. And then we write up the charges, whatever way we think we need to write them up in order to achieve that result. So in effect, what you're doing is rewriting the law, and you're telling people that I'm allowed to do this because the Constitution says prosecutors have discretion. The legislature can't tell me what crimes to prosecute. So therefore, this is how I'm doing it. And that's not what prosecutorial discretion is at all. And what these guys are doing is just as offensive as what judges do when they make up the laws they go along, which is they're completely rewriting the statutes.
And how significant was his walk back?
I think less than meets the eye. He certainly did say that, you know, if you use a gun to commit a robbery, that that's a felony, which is a departure from what the memo says. So in that sense, let's see what he does. In that sense, it's a walk back. But Rich, a lot of what he said yesterday was prosecutorial discretion. And he insisted that he was upholding the law by exercising it because prosecutorial discretion, you know, is in the Constitution. He continues to claim that people misunderstood what he wrote. And, you know, the other thing he said was, like, for example, with respect to people who assault police, he said those people are going to be held accountable. He didn't say those people were going to be subjected to the law, to the way the law is written. So he still has this weasel sort of out that, you know, they're going to look at every case and they're going to decide what fair treatment is. And they're not going to apply the laws as written. And what he means by accountable, and what you think you hear when he says accountable, I think are two different things.
So let's hit one last thing before we go. Also involves prosecutors not prosecuting crimes and horrendous consequences from that. This just amazing story that we would in the 21st century have train robberies in the West again. But we've focused last, I think there's a reporter out there who took some video and this went viral, and there's been a lot of focus now, just this astonishing level of packages stolen from trains coming in and out, I guess, of LA. And you've written very powerfully about this. So what's going on here and how can we stop it?
My God, these images, Rich, are just, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, and people should look at them for themselves. It's shocking. The only thing I can compare it to, I was in Kenya after the US embassy got bombed there. And I was there after they had, you know, weeks after they had cleaned up the main of it. But, you know, it looked like a war zone. And, you know, you look at these images of stuff strewn all over, you know, mounds and mounds and mounds of goods, you know, rotting in the sun, blowing in the breeze, mounted all over the rail yards. And it's just, I mean, it's shocking in the United States to see that in this day and age. And what's happening, you know, they're unfortunately the comparison to the 19th century Wild West ends, because in the Wild West of the 19th century, if you got caught robbing a train, there was going to be, you know, it wasn't going to be Alvin Bragg justice. Mm-hmm. It was going to be like actual prosecution and, you know, sentences with real teeth. So, the problem in California is this situation obtains because the rule of law no longer exists in the Los Angeles area. The prosecutor there, George Gascon, another progressive prosecutor of Los Angeles, basically has standards that, you know, between how bad the laws already are to begin with in California and then his exercise of prosecutorial discretion, nobody gets prosecuted. So what the legislature in California has done is basically make any theft of $950 or less is going to be treated as a misdemeanor. So things that you would think of as grand larceny and grand theft are being pled down. When he prosecutes them all at all, they're being pled down to simple trespass, which means the people essentially don't get prosecuted at all. And because both not only the people who would be inclined to commit crimes, but more importantly, organized crime networks which have sophisticated channels of obtaining and fencing stolen goods, have leapt on this. So what we're finding, according to Union Pacific, whose freight trains have been the most targeted by this, 90 freight trains a day are being robbed. Robberies year over year, as of the end of this year, are up 160%. From October of 2020 to October of 21, it was 356% up. We're talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of goods, including things like these quick test kits for COVID-19, which are such a thing, and that Biden is talking about the difficulty of getting them out and apologizing that he's behind the eight ball on that. If you're really looking for one, in some places until recently, you'd have been better off going to the train yard in Los Angeles and looking along the train tracks than going to your local Walgreens, because you're more apt to find them there. And what happens is these thieves get on the train. The trains slow down at well-known areas. In some place, what ends up happening is people get on them, they pull the brake, the train completely stops, and then these mobs get on, they cut the locks, which Union Pacific hasn't done a good job of bringing their locking systems into modern times, and then they get access to the freight cars, and they just take everything out and they rifle through it. What looks good, they keep. What doesn't look good, they throw on the tracks. And then, the scavengers come to the tracks to pick out what's been left behind. And what people are finding is, A, they won't be prosecuted, and B, they might find valuable stuff that they can fence or, sell in the places that people sell items that they've obtained. And they can make money off it. So it's no risk. And there's reward attached to it. So
you're not a huge advocate of federal power in most instances, but you think there is a case for the feds getting involved here?
Yeah, I do, Rich, because there's a lot of situations, I think, where the feds muscle in places that they're unnecessary and they're superfluous. But the whole rationale for having federal law enforcement in the first place is interstate and international commerce. I mean, everything that a federal prosecutor can do, including enforce the federal narcotics laws, it's based on interstate commerce. So as much as it's tempting to say, look, if these numbskulls in Los Angeles want to elect George Gascon as their district attorney, then they should live with what they've elected. And it is tempting to say that. But this is not a Los Angeles problem or even a California problem. It's a national problem, especially at a time when we have supply chain problems, rising costs, inflation, empty shelves, et cetera. And we have millions of dollars of stuff, which is very consequential to the broader economy, is being stopped. And we're talking about a substantial amount of stuff. I think our Dominic Pino wrote about this as well, that the two of the major ports of the United States are adjacent to the Los Angeles area, and 40% of the goods that come into the United States come in through those ports. So we're talking about the rail transportation component of the goods that come into the United States, which is a goodly percentage of it. This is a very significant problem of both interstate and international commerce. So it's a classic case of federal crimes. And it's part of the reason why, the federal statute books are festooned with stolen property crimes, whether it's transportation of stolen goods or receipt of stolen goods or fencing of stolen goods. There's all kinds of, even before you get to racketeering and other things that you can target organizations with and enhance sentences with, there's a ton of theft crimes in the federal code that are involved, that the nexus for which is interstate and international commerce. So I think the federal government has a real obligation to do something about this. And what alarms me is there's no evidence at the moment that they are doing anything about it. I don't want to say they're not, because, you know, maybe they're maintaining investigative secrecy and any day now we're going to get a big prosecution. But when I wrote the columns I wrote this week on this, I looked at the website of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles and the website of the FBI's field office in Los Angeles. And they both have places on their websites that itemize for you every single big case that they've brought that they want to call attention to and the media coverage of those cases. And there's not a whisper about what's going on on this area of the of the Union Pacific train lines near Los Angeles.
Okay, well,